You are listening to KBOO Portland. Please stay tuned for the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show and a look back through history at our relationship with Mexico.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party features DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KBOO Celeste Carey, in the MRG Foundation / KBOO Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
Good morning. Hey, it's a little stormy out. It's a little weird, but it's also the birthday of Cesar Chavez. And I want to first tell you that Abe is not with us today. He has other responsibilities. This is Joe Uris. This is KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. This is Talk Radio, and we do want to hear from you. The number is 231-8187. We don't have an online resource today. I want to do something a little different in celebration of the birthday of Cesar Chavez, but also because I think many of you can benefit, and you have to be patient if you know all of this, but can benefit from a little review of American-Mexican history and the situation historically of Mexican-Americans and other Latin American peoples in the United States. So be patient while I go through this stuff. Don't go away. This is good. So today we're celebrating a great labor leader, a strong advocate for minority rights, and a man who struggled tirelessly for farm workers, Cesar Chavez. I'm going to review this history of the U.S. and Mexico and Latin America in the U.S. Then we can go to the phones, and we can talk on issues, and this is really relevant to most of you listening, issues like farm labor and discrimination and the so-called war on drugs, and if you want to, street naming, though I'm not enthusiastic about that conversation, but we certainly can talk about it. Empires rise and fall. History is riddled with them. I assume that for the conquered or dominated, the experience is always almost always degrading and challenging. And for the so-called winners, there's often a certain level of guilt or pain as well as triumph. My point here is that this is the process of history. We can say who the good guys and the bad guys are if we want to, but it doesn't really compute in the long run of history. America early on took its ideological cues, that is this country, from its special status. That is, it was a modern republic with a continent to claim, no matter who stood in its path. Technologically, it was more advanced. Its numbers kept growing. And though it allowed, even encouraged African slavery, and gave no voting power to women, and initially no voting rights to the landless, it was, in form and tradition, a liberal republic, something very new in the world. Early on, as well, it assumed a stance of God-given inevitability to the rise of the nation. This concept, manifest destiny, served to both define and open the nation's boundaries to the whole of North America. So the ambitions of the nation grew as its boundaries grew. Flashing back, Spain conquered the Aztec nation or empire and in time created a new world of mestizo or mixed ancestry peoples. Using similar criteria to those argued by some first peoples in the U.S., the Mexican nation is, in part at least, an Indian nation, which is an interesting point, because that particular claim, that particular understanding of the relationship between race or ethnicity and class is part of what dogs Mexico had and has dogged Mexico from the initial conquest, and is very relevant to our kind of, and that is many Americans' kind of perception of race distinction between mestizo peoples and the Anglo population. But we'll come back to that. And this, while generally not generally acknowledged, is the basis for a whole host of racist and ethnographic prejudices directed by dominant Anglo culture. Essentially, there is a set of racist beliefs, an ideology of assumed superiority that has dogged white culture in the European context and in the American context. Okay, we're going to do some fast history. Mexico became independent from Spain in 1821. On the north, Mexico included, at that time, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, and California, and little bits of other space. In 1823, Mexico, in an effort to increase its population in Texas, remember, Texas was at that point largely dominated by native peoples, Comanche and others, and in order to, as it were, anglicize the region, Texas allowed Americans, Mexico allowed Americans to enter Texas, in fact, encouraged them. There were rules. They were to become Catholic, and they were to become citizens of Mexico. They did neither. By 1830, there were about 15,000 white Americans and 1,000 slaves. There were only 5,000 Mexicans, that is, people of Mexican ancestry, in Texas. There was an Anglo rebellion in 1826, the Republic of Fredonia, which Fredonia, you'll remember, is the nation in the Marx Brothers movie, Duck Soup. Anyway, there was the Republic of Fredonia, which failed. But in 1829, Mexico abolished slavery in Texas in response to this, I think largely, but also tried to tighten its cultural, political holds on these new Tejanos. In 1836, the Alamo had fallen. This is a famous event in American history. But Santa Anna, dictator of Mexico, had been captured because he made some really dumb tactical errors, and under threat of death allowed the creation of the Republic of Texas. It was never officially recognized by Mexico. In 1844, entry of Texas into the Union actually threatened the balance of a free versus slave state. President Tyler in 1845 used a joint resolution of Congress to gain Texas admission. Now, this is important because these joint resolutions are something that are still an option today for example, the Obama administration in situations where the so-called 60-plus majority in the Senate cannot be achieved. So this is a way to make things happen in a roundabout manner. All right, Congress agreed to gain Texas admission as a state. President Polk took office. Texas was a state with a border at the Nueces River and a claim to lands to the Rio Grande, the Rio Bravo, 150 miles to the south. Now, the United States at this point was dominated by Southern interests. The North was more conservative and more industrial in its attitudes toward land grabs. To provoke a war, the U.S. Army was directed to cross the Nueces and enter disputed territory. On the basis of that, which included an attack, by the way, Lincoln opposed this, and Thoreau actually went to jail to oppose taxes levied to pay for the war. A Southern-supported war was declared. It lasted from 1846 to 1848. It involved the invasion of Mexico and Mexico City. The martyrs of the military academy, teenage boys, who resisted, is still a holiday celebrated in Mexico. If you listen to the Marine Corps hymn, you hear from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Those halls are precisely the redoubts, the heights where the military school was. And it is, you know, this is important in Mexican history. We only know it in terms of that song. A treaty was made giving California and the north of Mexico to the U.S. By the way, Polk had wanted all of Mexico and was furious at Nicholas Trist, who made the agreement. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, February 2, 1848, gave 75,000 Spanish speakers and 150,000 approximately native people and nearly a third of Mexico to the United States. The treaty promised a continuation of religion, customs, language, land rights, and so on under Mexico. None of this was kept by the U.S. In New Mexico, land grant documents, for example, were mysteriously destroyed in fires. But that's just the beginning of that. In essence, the Mexican upper class with Spanish, direct Spanish ancestry, were in most cases degraded and brought to the level of a lower mestizo working class. And in history, we intervened in Mexico several times. In 1917, after border attacks by Pancho Villa, we intervened. In 1926, we were involved in enormous pressure on Mexico, and in the 1930s as well. Mexico underwent several revolutions in an effort to gain greater rights for its poorer population. Meanwhile, the Spanish-speaking population suffered discrimination and poverty, particularly in the United States. So let's jump ahead, if we may. Let's go to World War II. Mexican men joined the war effort and were very valiant in the war, Mexican-American men. By the way, the Germans had attempted in Latin America to make a case for their position, and a large part of the good neighbor policy developed by the Rockefellers, who owned enormous fincas, ranches in places like Venezuela, was part of that response, of a response to that interest by Germany in Mexico. Mexicans used German military tactics and military advisors and military weaponry to fight against the revolution in 1917. In those days, so-called Mexicans could not use public pools, could not go to classy restaurants. They were expected to be menial laborers. Very few finished high school. They were regarded as stupid because their primary language was often Spanish, were regarded as not only illiterate, but unable to communicate effectively. During World War II, on June 7, 1943, very important date, the so-called Zoot Suit Riots reached a crescendo in L.A. I don't know how many of you know the Zoot Suit Riots. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. In the war effort, people were supposed to wear conservative clothing with not too much material used. In defiance of that tradition, as a subcultural phenomenon among African Americans, a certain number of white working class men, and Mexican Americans, zoot suits became popular. A zoot suit has pegged bottoms of the trousers. Trousers come up almost to the middle of the chest. The material has lots of what are called pleats. That is, a lot of material is used in the pants as they peg down to the bottom. You actually had to take your shoes off to get the pants on. You wore a contrasting shirt and a contrasting tie, and your jacket was either what's called a one-button roll or a double-breasted jacket that broke, that is, ended, where your hands reached almost to your knees. So you had a very big jacket, very big pants, and very big shoulder pads. So zoot suits are really cool. I've always wanted a zoot suit. I got to tell you, there is actually a tailor in East L.A. who makes them, by the way, but they're kind of expensive. Anyway, those of you who wish to contribute to the Joe Uris Zoot Suit Absurdity Fund can make contributions under the table. At any rate, the zoot suit, the hat, all of this became indicative of an unpatriotic, I'm putting quotes around that, attitude. In fact, large numbers of Mexican-American youths were being rejected by the armed forces when it was discovered that they had tattooed between their thumb and forefinger a cross with several radiating lines, which was said to be the sign of the Pachucos. Pachucos were said to be Mexican-American gangsters. Now, Pachuco is actually a region of Mexico, but that's irrelevant. And when I was growing up in Southern California, we all knew about the Pachucos. That was scary. Pachucos. At any rate, this enormous frenzy of paranoia around any persons of color resulted in these riots, which, as I say, culminated in June of 43. Sailors and soldiers took taxis from the port at San Pete, at San Pedro, and went into East L.A., where they raped, I'm not making this up, where they pillaged, where they cut the hair and removed the zoot suits using razors from any Mexican-Americans they found. The authorities, if they didn't help, did nothing to stem the riot. In the 1940s, promised housing for Mexican-Americans was not built. By the mid-50s, instead of the housing promised in Chavez Ravine, the Mexican-American community got the Dodger Stadium. There's something here to be paid attention to in terms of Portland's recent history, I think. As the civil rights movement and the black struggle grew in the 60s and 70s, a similar movement developed among Mexican-Americans. And this is important. This was the movement that people like Cesar Chavez led. It was a movement that demanded, for example, that the terrible dropout rates in the high schools be altered. It was a movement that demanded respect, and it was a movement that demanded labor rights for this underrepresented and under and very much mistreated minority. What Chavez did with training as an organizer was to work directly in the fields to organize farm labor. And the famous flag, the black eagle in a white circle with a red surround, became an ominous sign for the growers in the Central Valleys of California. And he did another thing, Chavez, a very brilliant thing. He encouraged boycotts. We boycotted grapes. We boycotted lettuce. We forced most of the large growers to the table and in the process created better conditions. I mean, think about farm labor. You're sprayed with poisons. You're in the hot sun. You have inadequate sanitation facilities. You're living in horrible labor camps. You have no right to organize. You have no right to demand better wages. If you make any trouble at all, you're fired. You are barely making enough to eat and to live. So organizing the farm workers was a key factor. But in the cities, other organizations developed. The Brown Berets, the creation of the various political groups out of Chicago as well as Los Angeles, became a very significant factor in the organizing of the Latino community. And, in fact, in Los Angeles, when the police attempted to shut down rising anti-Vietnam War sentiment among Mexican-Americans, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times was murdered in cold blood, essentially, by the police. He was a Mexican-American. His death is yet to be avenged, as they say. But also, at that time, every effort was made to stamp out the cultural traditions of Mexican youth. The traditional parade, as it were, of cars on the weekends, low riders and so on, were systematically oppressed by the police, who perceived this as a real disorderly behavior. And I think to a large extent, the drug paranoia around marijuana is part of this as well. And this is something we can discuss. So I've given you just a little bit of history. And I've skipped a lot of the more modern stuff. I'm hoping that some of you out there will fill our history in. I'm hoping that many of you will call us. I really, really want to dedicate today's 1 hour not only to Cesar Chavez, but also to the important issue of a growing and significant minority who, by the way, are now the largest minority population in the Portland metropolitan area. So if we can, this one time, I'm hoping we can focus in on this talk show on the issues around the Mexican-American existence in America. I want to make another point briefly. The border between Mexico and the United States has always been more or less porous. It has not had the definition with the big fence and so on that it began to develop in the post-war period and that has reached a culmination now with electronic surveillance, overflight by drone aircraft, you name it, all of which is occasioned by two things. The first, the stop movement of people north for jobs. The second, and now growing ever more important, to stop the drug cartels from moving their product north and, not incidentally, moving American money and weapons south into Mexico. If, I would point this out, very important, if there was not a market for these drugs, if there was not an effort to sell these weapons out of the United States, this issue would be resolved much more easily. But the fact of the matter is that cocaine, heroin, marijuana, speed, all are moving either from Mexico, where they're manufactured, or through Mexico and out and back up to the States. And this is an economic problem. This is a supply-demand problem. This is an issue that needs to be addressed in much more profound ways than, hey, let's have a border patrol, you know? I mean, a citizen border patrol. So I do want to hear from you, but I do ask that we focus in just today, on issues relating to the Hispanic peoples in North America and to Mexican history itself. I also want to comment on a book that I recommend called Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt by John Gibler, an excellent and recent addition to the literature in English about the history of Mexico. We do have callers, and I want to remind you the number is 231-8187. Let's go to our first. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yeah, just a real simple question here. Is there such a thing as an illegal alien?
Illegal in the sense of not being here legally? Sure.
There is. What should be done about him?
Well, you're asking me what I think should be done? I think it's an incredibly difficult problem. One of the ways that I would approach it, and this is pretty radical and profound, is to support a equalization of wages and benefits in Mexico and Latin America and the United States, which makes it less desirable to be an illegal alien. I also think there needs to be a process for creating legality for those who are already here. And that's a difficult one because right now we're in a depression. Well, let's call it a recession. And so we have more labor than there is jobs. And by the way, the number of Mexicans and Guatemalans and El Salvadorians, et cetera, coming north has decreased because there's just not the work here. So I don't give you an easy answer. There really isn't an easy answer to this problem.
So you think people who have entered here illegally should be given a free ride?
No.
No?
I don't think I said that. Did I say that? No, I didn't say that.
Legalized.
I think there should be a process for legalization, yes.
So they should be legalized?
Eventually, yes.
And why is that?
Well, let's start out with what I said historically. This whole Southwest region, including California and Tejas and so on, was one-third of Mexico. It was gained through a war. That border has always been porous. The population of Spanish-speaking people in the region has always been large. Our Anglo denial of the reality of that has led to an enormous degree of suffering and to a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble of all sorts. I think the resolution of this problem rests with economic justice and, to some degree, with the creation of a more open process for citizenship.
So you think anybody that wants to come into the country should be able to do it through a porous border?
No.
No?
No.
Should our borders be enforced or not?
Should our borders be enforced or not? Is it physically possible to enforce our borders?
That's
perhaps
not what I asked.
Else?
I said,
well, I know it's not what you asked. I only answer a question that's rational. What you're asking is a theoretical. Should our borders be enforced? Well, yeah, every nation should be able to enforce its borders. Does that work? I'm not sure that it would. I'm not sure that it can.
It works in many countries to a large part.
Yeah, it works in many countries to a large part, and it doesn't work in many countries to a large part. And it's not a solution. Nationalist solutions at this point in history may not work. Now, you know,
at this point in history, they will work very well.
Well, what you do, and I think it's important for you to acknowledge this, is you take a historical example, and you then overgeneralize about it, and you make a point contention that you're trying to demonstrate a kind of illogic to my argument. Now, that's okay, but you always, let me finish, you always, it might be a monologue if you don't let me finish. I guess it'll be a monologue. I'm going to let you go. I'm not going to play with that today. All right, 231-8187. Gabriella, welcome to Cable.
Hello, thank you. I wanted to commend you for making this such a great topic. It's enlightening, and I just wanted to make a commentary. I am an American-Mexican, and my grandfather, who passed away, he was a bracero.
Uh-huh.
And for those that...
By the way, for those of us who are unfamiliar, bracero means farm worker.
Yes.
Okay.
And he came up to the state of Oregon back in the early 1900s.
Mm.
And throughout the process of what you'd explained, just to add on to America. We, Mexican-Americans, American-Mexicans, I just feel that we just need to have these kind of talks to enlighten people. I think knowledge is important to know the history so that people can understand. And what Cesar Chavez did was a great movement for a huge for our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so, not to make this a longer topic, because I'm sure you have a lot of comments to say, but I just wanted to express being here. We American Mexicans, we contributed. We understand the problems that are arising. However, it's more or less we need to face the problems direct on and stop the stereotype and the generalizing of the culture itself.
I appreciate your call, Gabrielle.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to ask people now to focus in on issues of the Latino peoples in the United States, issues of Mexico and its relationship to the United States, Mexican history, all the issues related to the situation of Hispanic people in the New World. In the United States. Okay, so I'm eager to hear from you. 231-8187. And Story, how are you?
I can't wait to find out. Surely you know of Jose, Simon Bolivar.
Simon Bolivar, yes.
And yeah, well, however you
doesn't matter anyway. Yes, I know of him. He was one of the liberators, particularly in the north of South America.
Well, the point being that Central and South America have essentially had European forms of government since the early 19th century.
That's right.
Okay, and the language has the official language have been European languages, and even state religions have. In fact, if you question people from south of the border, if you ask them, do you subscribe to any Mesoamerican religions, or are you, or what is your religion? And my point is Europeanization has taken place in Central and South America since the 19th century.
Yes and no. We can explore that some more.
Yeah, of course. But I'm talking about legally speaking, the official governments, official religions. And so I just wanted to put that out there right away, you know, the issue that, that only North America is Europeanized.
Okay. I see your point, and it's very important to understand that the whole of the Western Hemisphere, has been, it were, Europeanized.
Right. Okay, and long as you're on this topic, I want to point out that again, and I hope you'll address the whole issue of what constitutes representation, sovereign representation in a government. You know, are we to have, who is to determine the destiny of nations, or is it to be determined by some kind of ad hoc judgments about the past, you know, and some kind of atonement for the past? Or are we going forward in terms of having a representative democracy whereby the citizenship determines the destiny of the nation? Or are we simply going to be carrying on some kind of historical self-flagellation and atonement for our past? And, I mean, I think that is the real hard point, is that, you know, legally, I mean, the fellow caller earlier asked, is there such a thing as an illegal alien?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't have sovereignty unless you have a legal definition of what constitutes citizenship.
And also clear borders.
Okay.
No, I'm just trying to give you some support here.
I'm only making observations here. Yeah. I'm not trying to make an argument or a point. And I'm simply saying this is the difficult part about this issue, is that, you know, sovereignty is what you have to have in order to have representation as a, you know, for the quote unquote citizenry. And the trouble is that by definition, citizen is exclusionary. You know,
You can also argue that citizen is inclusionary. I mean, it's a fair
Well, I'm saying legally, if, you know, what constitutes one's right to vote? What constitutes one's obligation to pay taxes?
Okay,
we're talking about orderly government. We're talking about government.
Yes.
And is it of the people, for the people, by the people? And I'm just saying that these are all issues of sovereignty, statehood, and you cannot have representation. You cannot even have budgetary policy. You can't have any of the elements that we associate are the condition of government without the legal definitions of all of this. And I'm saying, though, the whole point is to give control of a nation's destiny to its citizens,
mm-hmm.
its sovereign citizens. And I'm saying that if we embark on this track of saying that, we're going to have, our raison d'etre is going to be atonement for the past. I mean, every country in the world would cease existing right away, including Israel.
No, I think your point is an interesting one. I think part of it I agree with, and part I'm not sure if I agree with.
I'll get off the line.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Story. This is a nation of nations. And I suspect that many nations are nations of nations. History is about fluid borders, about vast changes, about empires rising and falling, small nation states surviving and not. So in the de facto realities, a lot goes on historically. And in fact, we don't have simple definitions of this sort of thing. For example, if we look at the history of Mexico, large parts of Mexico, the first language that people speak is not Spanish. Large parts of Mexico are not, in a very significant sense, conquered. Mexican history has been replete with struggles to gain rights for people who have been denied rights. The color bar and the class bar in Mexico are almost synonymous, and they are in some ways, or have been in some ways, in the United States, almost synonymous. I got to do a little business. At 9, on Political Perspective, the paraphrasing speaks with Ayagar Ibarbanel. I'm sorry, I my eyes are bad and I can't read as well as I should. Anyway, he's Israeli-born psychotherapist who's written about Jewish trauma, survival instinct, and paranoia, I assume in the context of the Israel-Palestine issue. At 9:30, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Andrew Nikifornik, author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. Very, very relevant to what's going on today. The tar sands, as many of you probably know, are in Alberta, Canada. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein interviews Marjorie Cohen, president of the National Lawyers Guild, an organization with which I'm familiar and I think it's great, about the Spanish judge targeting members of the Bush administration for war crimes. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Later, Dennis speaks with former CIA operative Ray McGovern about President Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. At 11, on stage and studio, here about Tears of Joy's theater production of The Fabulous Bear. Also, art historian W.J.T. Mitchell talks about the impact of imagery on the psyche. At 11:30, on Art Focus, Ava Lake, a wonderful artist and a very amusing person, interviews local artist Chris Haberman about his upcoming shows. All this and more on KBOO 90.7 here in Portland. Again, the number to call, 231-8187. Today and today only, we are speaking about citizens whose first language may or may not have been Spanish, but whose cultural traditions are Hispanic, particularly our relationship with and the history of Mexico and the various issues attendant there, too. So it's Dean. You're on the air, Dean.
Yeah. I would just like to put something out there about the drug trade.
Sure.
Anyway, I was thinking that it would be more reasonable for the government to legalize all drugs and then control them and tax them, and it would create a lot of revenue, and it would take the illegality out of the drug trade.
Well, it's an interesting idea, but in terms of what are so-called hard drugs, you might have a hell of a kill-off initially.
Well, I mean, yeah, but if...
I don't think most junkies experience pure heroin too often.
Well, I know, but just the fact that if you were to control them, the government was to control the drug trade and set the prices, and it would take the illegal element out of the...
Well, it might take the profits out, and this is an idea that is actually being tried in Switzerland right now. But remember, Switzerland's a very small country.
Yeah.
Talking about well-controlled borders,
yeah.
You certainly have that there. But I think that first of all, this is a very complicated issue. My personal view is that marijuana ought to be legalized. Probably taxation makes some sense. But you know, once you get the government involved in it, are we going to have controls of the amount of tetrahydrocannabinols in marijuana? Are we going to price it based on the amount of the high elements in the drug? How are we going to deal with it in terms of its prescription utilization? A whole host of problems arise outside of the area of free market. And I'm assuming that once the government is involved, it doesn't stay a free market any more than the liquor business does. But
The liquor also is a factor. I mean, the liquor is about one of the strongest drugs that's available.
Right, and we have lots of alcoholics. I don't have a strong position on the question of other types of drugs and their addictive potential. I mean, I know they're very addictive. I know that it makes more sense to treat the addiction as a
social problem.
Well, a social problem and a psychological disorder, and a physical disorder, than it does to put a lot of people in prison, which is what we've done.
Yeah.
We're spending, I think, something like $50,000 per prisoner now. We have the largest prison population of any nation on earth, and it's an incredible waste of resources.
Isn't about like about a third of the prison population in there for marijuana?
Well, I don't know the number, but I've heard it's a large number.
Yeah.
So obviously something other than our current drug policy needs to be adopted. I'm not really focused in on this issue, though. We will do a show in the near future about this. But you raise some interesting points. Right now, what we're experiencing, at least in the news, is the problem of these highly organized drug cartels who have challenged the power of the Mexican government in the process of making huge fortunes, getting weapons from essentially entrepreneurs in the U.S., and actually getting their income from U.S. Drug dealers and drug users. So we have a kind of a terrible problem that has, at least as half of its component, American citizens' desires to both make money and to use these drugs. So it's a real and serious problem, challenging the authority of the government in Mexico and doing a great deal of damage, not to mention all the murders that are taking place in cities like Phoenix, Arizona.
Yep.
Okay, so anyway, thanks for the call, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, 231-8187, we're focusing in on Mexico, Mexican-American relations, the issue of the huge Hispanic population in the United States, and I guess questions of citizenship in that context. 231-8187, Scott, you're on the air.
Hello, Joe.
Hiya.
I really appreciate the serious Joe coming out today.
Oh, you know.
I have 2 points. One is just some place names from the Mexican or Hispanic perspective, and then the militarization of the border.
Sure.
So I went to Spanish school for about a year when I was in the military and was stationed 2 years in Panama.
Mm-hmm. Well, my Spanish is terrible, so I apologize for any errors I might have made.
Well, here's just some states. So let's say you wanted to come to America and you spoke Spanish and you got out a map and you'd see the state of Florida, which means flowery. Texas or Tejas means tiles, like floor tiles. Colorado means reddish.
Mm-hmm.
Nevada means snowy. Montana means mountain. Los Angeles means the angels, and San Francisco is St. Francis, and Rio Grande is the big river.
Yes, which in Mexico used to be known, I think it still is, as the Rio Bravo.
The Brave River.
Yes.
So the militarization of the border, I found something fascinating, and you always find it at KBOO, which is we had a previous guest, a professor, that actually said that the killings in along the border were in most part due not to drugs, but to the trade in human trafficking.
You know, that may be true. This is something I don't know
about. Let's just assume the professor's correct.
Okay.
Maybe that's why they call him professor.
Well, who knows? They used to call me professor until
I quit
doing it.
But here's the link that I don't think he made, but he didn't necessarily, he wasn't asked the question, which is, if we can actually transport, we would probably agree, thousands, if not tens of thousands of human beings cross the border even now,
uh-huh.
a year, they are the mules for drugs. So if you have heroin or cocaine and or concentrates or ecstasy, whatever it may be, and now meth, because we've traced the mega meth labs down to Mexico, if you can transport human beings, they can also be backpack carriers for your drugs. So if we cannot stop the human trafficking, people legitimate desire to come to America, then you'll never stop the drugs. So the only way that the militarists can think of is to have a wall similar to the Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very ironic that we are building, as it were, a Berlin Wall.
Right. You and I grew up when the Berlin Wall was a symbol of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are actually contemplating this when Mexico is our dear friends. And imagine if we took the other relationship. What if, like as you said, equalization of wages, allowing both Americans to go and live and work and play in Mexico for extended periods, you know, like lighten up so that we have money to spend. We like the sun. And
well,
the
in fact, a lot of Americans, retirees particularly, do live in Mexico.
Right, but what we could do is some sort of reciprocation where instead of just trying to make the people here that are legal, mm-hmm. there is a legitimate argument that 10 years from now there will be 6 or 10 million more people that are, quote, illegal, and then we'll make them legal. So maybe, like you said, equalization and a sincere discussion about opening up not just Mexico, but the last point, by the way, the wall would be terrible, down to South America, other than Brazil and a few of the states like Suriname, which are leftovers from the European conquest, they speak Spanish. So the Inter-American Highway, if you go from Mexico, only stops at between Panama and Colombia. So there's like a 50-mile segment that's not built, but conceivably anyone could drive, or a trucker with goods could drive all the way down to the tip of South America if we were friendly, if we completed the highway, and if we actually, you know, had some sort of way of not being afraid of each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my personal view is that the border should be open.
Absolutely.
And my personal view is equalization of wages, the allowing of a union organization, the creation of greater democracy throughout the region, the honoring of indigenous peoples. All of these are reasonable and smart moves in the long run. Hopefully they will take place. Right now, we're struggling on a lot of fronts as we are moving into what I think may be very possibly a serious depression.
Yeah, Joe, one other thing.
Sure.
I went down to Mexico to Mazatlan, which I believe is Portland's sister city.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and they had direct flights, which I think they've since canceled. But the thing is that first off, I noticed that it was an Indian city. I mean, mm-hmm. literally, I could not see a Spaniard or European-type face except for some of the government officials or people that looked like they had more money.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of people were literally Indians.
Well, and there are struggles going on in Mexico right now around the rights of indigenous people.
And that's the other thing I want to say. So we went to the town of Tequila, where the famous beverage comes from. And on the way there, we went through like 3 or 4 military checkpoints where there were literally army guys with automatic weapons and behind barricades and sandbags checking everyone's vehicle. And so they really are under a militarized state, and I think it's important that if we start squeezing Mexico, we think we have problems now. If the Mexicans actually think that they have to be hostile towards Americans and not just accept us as friends, then, you know, that could change.
Yes, it could. And I think that I would say racist-based set of assumptions or historically-based sets of assumptions in terms of relations between the United States and Mexico need to be rethought. I want to give some others an opportunity, though. I really appreciate your call, man. I also want to announce that I was just handed this, that there's going to be a march today, Cesar Chavez celebratory march, beginning at Portland the PSU Park Blocks at noon. So that's today. That's kind of a cool thing. Last one of those marches I went on was really fun. And very, God, I'm going to say this and you're going to hate me for it. Very colorful. I'm sorry. But anyway, it is very cool and a very important thing. So if you're interested at all in having a good time today and you're not too worried about the rain, get out at noon at the Park Blocks of Portland State and march around the city. All right. 231-8187. We're talking about Mexican and Mexican-American relations with the larger government of the United States. And I'm hoping for more women callers, but right now let's go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Gosh, it's... Sorry that I am not the feminist.
No, don't apologize for your sex. Go on.
Oh, and the rain never stops us. We're Portlanders. I just wanted to talk, and thank you, Joe, by the way. This is an exquisitely important topic. The history
You're welcome.
Is good. Philosophically a little more into this concept of the militarization of our border. I know that much of it is rooted, much of our history, as you've already explained over the hour, is rooted in these kind of racial breakdowns, this pecking order, this so forth. But look at the walls all around the planet, especially the walls that are being built in the West Bank and such. I don't want it to come to that, of course, but beyond that, the current militarization that Scott spoke of there in Mexico, the rush to the border that actually the federal government had to bring in, and the federal government of Mexico had to bring in to places like Juarez and the state of Chihuahua, and over into Tijuana. It is an example of what they feel they have to do because of the levels of violence. And it is not necessarily rooted, although it could be, since so much of the government of Mexico is indeed the ruling class, the European Mexcaca, is it? Mexcaca? I forget what the name is. There's the Mayan Indians and so forth. I'm trying not to pretend to be an anthropologist, but I'm wondering. The question is this. I fear for our own safety in this country because of this enmity and because of the militarization, which is now taking place by us, our National Guards, our armies, our militarization, our drones, our whatnot is being sent to this border, theirs to their border. And meanwhile, it is you, it is me, it is the common folk of each of these countries that is about to be put under a really intense thumb from border to border, no matter where we're at in the country. And it bothers me that this militarization, although it seems needed, isn't in any way considered acceptable and thus transferable to our own country. I'd love to get your response, but I need to get off the air because you need some women callers.
Okay.
Thanks,
Joe. You bet. Well, just briefly, I think that the whole concept of borders as we currently understand them are a reflection of the inequities, racism, nationalism, and eventually we'll have to go by the boards. Eventually meaning, I don't know, 10 years, 100 years, whatever. Right now, our border with Canada, well, until very recently, was pretty much an open border, presumably because both were seen as predominantly Anglo cultures. The Mexican border has always been a more difficult border to cross, both because of its geography, you know, much of it is really tough terrain, and secondarily, because of our prejudices and the longstanding discomfort of both Mexico and the United States with each other. I don't want to talk a great deal more. I want to give a lot of more people an opportunity. I'm particularly looking for women callers. But I did want to add a couple of things in more recent times. For example, in March of 1968, 10,000 Hispanic students, Mexican-American students, left the high schools, went on strike in the high school system in L.A. I don't know how many of you know that. Very important. Asking for honorable treatment, asking for opportunities to have college programs, college entry programs, asking that they really be made literate and be taught adequately. This was an immense surprise to the Anglo establishment in L.A., no surprise to the Hispanic population in Los Angeles. Very big, also a reflection of the struggles of Cesar Chavez, of many others. I remember one, if you go down Olympic Boulevard in L.A., as you move toward East L.A., there's a bunch of murals in public housing there, and one of them is a brown beret guy, and he looks very stern, and he says, "We are not a minority in Southern California." You know, it's not clear at this point that this is the case at all. So a lot of assumptions about that border, a lot of assumptions about the people who live in California, a lot of assumptions about the legitimacy of the successful conquest of a third of Mexico need to be challenged, not denied, not refuted, but challenged. And I want to go to the phones again, 231-8187. Crystal, you're on the air.
Greetings, Joe. You're doing a splendid job of moving through callers today.
Thank you.
Anyway, as a Nixon-era child, I immediately think that the profit motive is being addressed by the CIA, that they have their hands in that pocket and will interfere no matter what with trying to get rid of the cartels because...
Oh, you think the CIA is making money off the cartels?
I don't know. I've thought so since Vietnam. But anyway...
Well, we definitely, we know that... I mean, you're not blowing smoke. We definitely know that during the Vietnam era, the heroin traffic in Southeast Asia and later in Europe was dominated by CIA entrepreneurs. I mean, that's just a known fact.
Mm-hmm.
McCoy wrote about this.
I just have this... Now, why do we always go for the guns? Why don't we do what obviously worked with alcohol? kill the cartels by killing their profits. And also, it would if we legalize the drugs, the Afghan farmers will suddenly be legitimized. They'll be growing a legal crop, and the Taliban won't need Taliban support.
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, that whole mess in Afghanistan is largely fueled by the reality of the most profitable crop in the region is not cotton.
Nope.
It's poppies.
Well, and then in support of your further show topics,
mm-hmm.
how big a part of the United States economy is arms manufacturers?
I don't know the actual percentage, but it's significant. I would add to that, since you raised the question, that we're discovering only now that reducing arms budgets would impact every single state in the union because the arms industry, that's the airplane industry and so on, have cleverly put manufacturing in every state that they possibly could, making members of Congress kind of hostage to those industries. So it's very hard to have a serious arms reduction policy in the United States as a consequence of that.
And so we manufacture guns of every stripe and the other things to support war. So
yeah, the real obscenity.
How do we possibly pursue peace on any border?
Yeah, the real obscenity is I'll show you my gun if you'll show me yours. At any rate, sorry.
And we have to sell the most recent model and then immediately have to come up with something better because we have to have something better than what we just sold to our friends.
Right. Well, the most recent of these massive expenditures is the F-22, which is a beautiful airplane that can be so fast and so invisible to radar and so cool and shoot down the enemy so well. The only problem is we don't have a lot of enemies who have aircraft of even close to equivalent power.
Yeah. Anyway, we're busy sending guns to Mexico because there's money in it.
Well,
and we could be growing we could be growing legal crops here that grow well and they're good for the soil and very useful, mainly hemp. And
the whole hemp question. We haven't even begun to discuss the usefulness of hemp as a non-smoking product.
Which works really well in Canada, by the way.
Yes. I want to make a confession here. I use hemp milk on my cereal.
Good for you.
It's tasty. It has high protein. And I hate to tell you this, folks, it doesn't seem to have any psychedelic properties.
Neither does smoking rope.
Well, it will destroy your lungs.
Anyway, next caller.
All right, thanks a lot for the call. 231-8187. We are discussing both the history of and the current situation of people of Latino background in the United States and the history of and issues around Mexico. I said earlier that it was a mestizo culture, that it was a conquered, that Mexico really was conquered by the Spanish, that the Spanish were eventually kicked out in the 1820s. That Mexico had at one time all of California, all of Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, well, parts of Nevada, Nevada, Utah, and Texas. And that, in fact, American adventurers created the state of Texas, which actually had an undesirable impact on the evenness between the states, 13 slave states, 13 free. It added to the inevitability of the Civil War.
It also involved the slaughter of many Native American peoples and the systematic destruction of the culture of Spanish-speaking peoples in all of those regions. But I also wanted to add some modern stuff. I wanted to point out that Cesar Chavez was among many who organized, actually in response to the civil rights movement, I think, in large part, who organized farm workers, who organized students, who organized all over the Southwest and in and we don't want to leave this out, in Chicago, and who created a movement which still persists, still exists in the world today. And we see some impact of that in the history of all places, Portland, Oregon, the whitest city in the United States. I want to hear from you, 231-8187. All right. Joe, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have one quick short story I'd like to relate.
Sure.
Used to travel quite a bit down south and discovered that the good rope was always grown quite a bit further south than the border, and not wanting to cross into that southern region, bringing any on our trips north, we always used to stop about 7 miles south of the border of this one particular area where we crossed a lot. Because they had several checkpoints, and so we'd stop below the lowest checkpoint and mm-hmm. pull off in the desert, and there's a real convenient spot that seemed destined to be a good place to sequester some future provisions for our southern trip until we got, you know, further south.
What exactly are you what are you talking about here now? What
about this little place? We called it the hiding corner.
I see. What were you hiding exactly?
Our own personal consumables for the long trip south.
Ah, are you talking about consumables or combustibles?
Well, both.
Ah, I see. Okay, just trying to get some sense
right.
of this.
So we'd sequester these things, you know, and on our very first stop there, we're camped out. It's getting dusk, and these two young children, maybe 8, 10 years old, are mm-hmm. in the desert with burlap sacks, and they're picking up manure for fuel,
mm-hmm.
you know, fuel their stoves. And this little girl walks into our camp, and we're sitting around the fire, and she walks up, and she says in Spanish, "Did you come here to bury something?" It was just apparent. And then we got to looking around, and everywhere we looked were little diggings where apparently other people were doing the same thing. So we call that the hiding corner.
Mm. Let's hope that what we're talking about being buried is supplies of something, not people.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, this
okay. I just, yeah, I'm just trying to...
Just so we'd have something to get us through the desert on the way south. Anyway, it was just that area was called the hiding corner, and everywhere we looked, it was just little diggings. And not wanting to be obvious, we decided, well, we'll bury our stuff and then build a fire over it. So we did, and we got our campfire, and we had some psychedelics there. And
well, I hate to interrupt your tales of wonder and pleasure, but we've actually run out of time. I hope people will go out and celebrate.
I want to say that I really appreciate the serious conversation this morning without all the flippant remarks and the fact that you went through a lot of callers. Thank
all right.
You.
Thanks a lot. All right. We'll see you all next week. Happy Cesar Chavez birthday.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, March 31st. Portland Central America Solidarity Committee meets Wednesday, April 1st, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Liberty Hall, 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. PCASC is a grassroots organization working for international solidarity and immigrant rights. This is a general meeting for anyone interested in Latin American solidarity work, local immigrant rights work, or fighting free trade agreements. The Sister Circle Support Group meets Wednesday, April 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. The Sister Circle is a support group for women of color in higher education, which meets biweekly on Wednesdays in the Women's Resource Center at Portland State University. Children are always welcome in the space. The facilitators of this group are Erica Lee Johnson, president of the NAACP, and Carmen Anderson, coordinator of the Returning Women's Program. United Poor People attends Portland City Council meetings Wednesday morning between 9 a.m. and 12 noon to lobby for the rights of the homeless. Every citizen of Portland is allowed 3 minutes to address the mayor and city council. The UPP also meets in Chapman Square across from City Hall every day at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Meetings are consensus-based and open to the public. The People's Farmers Market takes place Wednesdays, 2 to 7 p.m. It's a year-round market at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell Boulevard. Knitters, crocheters, needlepoint artists, and other crafters come to the Cube Space Wednesday nights from 5 to 6 p.m. to show off your current project, ask for advice on a problem, or just enjoy the company. The Cube Space is at 622 Southeast Grand Avenue, Portland. There is a free sack lunch concert Wednesday, April 1st at noon at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Muriel Hurst student Ebony Terrell presents a piano recital. Do you want to take that next step as a member and become a volunteer? There are many varied trainings and events you can be part of. Contact Ani, KBOO Volunteer Coordinator, email at volunteer@kboo.fm or call the station at 503-231-8032, extension 213. This has been Paula for the Community Calendar for KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio, transmitting from Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.
And it is 1.5 minutes past 9 a.m., and yes, you are listening to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up on Political Perspectives, Per Fagerin speaks with Avigail Abubanel, an Israeli-born psychotherapist who has written about Jewish trauma, survival instinct, and paranoia. At 9:30, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. And then stay tuned at 10 o'clock. It's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. 10:15, it's Flashpoints. At 11, we have Stage and Studio today. And then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. So stay tuned to KBOO.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagerin, KBOO News and Public Affairs. And our guest is Avigail Abubanel, who is a psychotherapist who was born and grew up in Israel and then moved to Australia, and she has written several articles, and one in particular, I think it was in Counterpunch, was called Jewish Survival Instinct or Jewish Paranoia? So that's, I guess, what we'll be talking about. Avigail, are you welcome to KBOO?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
In this article, you talk about, what does Jewish survival instinct mean, anyway?
I'm a firm believer that one of the things that is at the core of Jewish faith or Jewish culture or identity, if you want, is a sense of the importance of survival. I think Jewish existence is focused too much or is focused on survival. And there is a strong belief in Jewish people of all kinds. You don't have to be ultra-religious to have that. But there is a strong belief that Jewish existence is not guaranteed and that Jews are always the victim and are always going to face some sort of an annihilation attempt. The Holocaust is seen as one of many. It's not the first one that Jewish people focus on, but it's certainly the one that kind of cemented that belief. And I grew up that way, too. I grew up in Israel, and that's what we've always believed. And when I said you don't have to be religious, it's because the Israeli state is fundamentally not a religious state, and yet people still do believe that. And there's always a sense of, there's always an explanation for that. There's always a sort of a, what seems like a real world reason for why that is. For instance, here in Australia, there is a strong focus in the Jewish community here on anti-Semitism. There are people who spend their entire time just combing the media every day and the news, just looking for incidents of anti-Semitism. There is very much a focus on Jewish victimhood, and also the sense that nobody else can be a victim in the same way that Jewish people can. The Jewish victimhood is somehow special and different from the victimhood of other people. Although there have been many genocides in human history and many people have suffered and are still suffering in different places around the world, there's a kind of a belief in specialness in Judaism, and that includes the specialness of victimhood because, well, it's just a part of what I believe is Jewish identity. I've started to write about this and to think about it, and I'm not the only one within worldwide sort of Jewish community, if you can call it that, but there's a few Jewish people around the world who are thinking now in terms of Jewish identity being kind of a cultish identity. So, and we believe that survival and fear about not surviving and victimhood are very, very central themes in Jewish identity, if not the most central ones.
Well, now you're right about Jewish trauma, and you know, you say it goes back to biblical times.
Yes, I do. Again, I think that the whole idea of being a persecuted people and having suffered trauma at the hands of various persecutors throughout history of the Jewish people is a central theme. And trauma mentality, I'm a psychotherapist, I work a lot with people who have suffered trauma, and I myself am a survivor of trauma from childhood. Mm-hmm. Trauma can shape your entire identity, and you learn to see the world a certain way when you have it. It's and it fits perfectly with the whole of Jewish mentality. Trauma, identity, victimhood, survival. Survival becomes the most important thing for people who have suffered trauma. And when you meet people who have had that, I have a lot of sympathy and a lot of time for that, because I know how hard it is to just live day to day when you have suffered like that. But for a whole nation to walk around feeling that way, that can be quite dangerous, especially if that nation happens to have arms and a military force, because that can translate to quite a lot of aggression. Israel as a society, I believe that the Israeli society displays both sides of the coin of trauma, that is self-destructive tendency as well as aggressive tendencies. People who have trauma would have two possible reactions to trauma, and of course that in reality it's not that simple. People have a bit of both, but some people have more of a tendency to inflict suffering on themselves, and that's when you see people who are very depressed or who have drug problems or who in one way or the other they hurt themselves in the way they live. And there are people who have more of a tendency to lash out at other people and become aggressive and take out their trauma, if you like, on others. Israel certainly displays both. So in other words, what I'm doing is I'm extrapolating from individual psychology to a whole nation and saying, I think this whole nation is suffering from trauma and this is what it's doing. And I'm tracing it back to Jewish culture, to Jewish identity, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish values. And I'm saying this is all part and parcel of the same thing.
Well, can you tell, what was it like going to school in Israel?
Frankly, I loved school. I was one of those good kids, and I loved study, and I really enjoyed school. And I went to school in primary school. I did during the 70s, and I think I enjoyed a bit of a bubble in Israeli education system. I'm yet to do research about what happened at that time, but I think we enjoyed a very good level of education. I really enjoyed school. I felt really accepted and really valued. There was a real appreciation of achievement back then. Because I was a good student, I really enjoyed a lot of support and respect from my teachers and other students. And so school was a very positive experience. But what I didn't know back then was that I was being indoctrinated in a certain way. When you're a kid and you're being taught what you're taught, and especially if you're good at it, you don't really think much about what it is that they're telling you. And everything is being taught in a really nice way, you know. So all the stories about our victimhood are told in a nice way. There is a the stories of the Jewish festivals, and you learn that at school, and it's involved, and what's involved is, you know, it's a lot of songs, and there's a lot of performing, and there's a lot of food, and things like that. So it doesn't seem like a bad thing to you.
Mm-hmm.
At least didn't to me. One thing I do remember, though, which I think was pretty horrible, was the way that they've exposed us to stories of the Holocaust and images of the Holocaust from a very, very young age, which I think would be outrageous these days. If anybody did that today, I shouldn't think their parents should sue them. But in Israel, they exposed us to slides, images, photos and stories and poetry and art from the Holocaust at a very young age, and it will be there all the time. And I think that that contributed quite dramatically to my own mental state later on in life. I don't think that should be done that way. When they teach you about the Holocaust, as a child, you're supposed to feel terrible feelings about it and be outraged and be and kind of get the message that these people had something against us and that it's still going on somehow. And there is no kind of psychological support for that. There is no kind of any kind of opportunity to debrief emotionally or something like that. It's very deliberately designed to traumatize people, and it did that to me and to my whole generation. And I don't know what they're doing now over there, but if they're still doing the same thing, then it would have the same outcome. And that contributes to traumatizing subsequent generations who've never seen Nazis, who've never experienced anti-Semitism. See, growing up in Israel, I've never experienced anti-Semitism because I was We've taken our being Jewish, our Jewishness, for granted. It was we were all Jews, if you like, at least where I grew up, and there was no question of anybody being anything else. So I've never experienced anti-Semitism, never met any Nazis in my life, never been a victim of persecution, and yet I grew up with the same persecution complex that everybody else does, and I attribute that partly to the education system and in part to the way that they have been teaching us the Holocaust, about Holocaust and anti-Semitism.
So what was
the young age.
Uh-huh. What was the theme? I mean, did they show you a lot of films then, or how did it work
back
out?
Back then, audiovisual capacity was not as good as now, so it was mostly slides with photos that I now know are quite famous photos. You know, the famous corpses in piles and shoes.
Oh, right.
You know, those famous...
A little boy holding up his hands.
Yeah, the picture in the Jew having his beard cut in the streets, the kids in pajamas in the camps. You know, when the camps were liberated, many soldiers took photos, and they're now quite famous, quite well known. And a lot of we had readers, you know, in literature, Hebrew literature, and a lot of stories that were written about the Holocaust and memoirs of people and the heart-wrenching stuff, you know, growing up in Israel, where I did not grow up in a rich family. I grew up in what we would call working class, but we always had enough to eat. And then you would read stories about the poor girl in the ghetto, in Warsaw ghetto, who hasn't had anything to eat, and all she had was potato peels, you know. And I even remember it now because it was so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, it just, you know, it gets to you. It's really, really scary, and it's really painful. But that was the education system at the time.
Did they teach you much about, you know, there was some resistance, like in the Warsaw Ghetto and in Vilna? Did they go into that very much?
Well, we knew.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as children grow older, of course, they make the material a bit more sophisticated, and they tell you more. But yes, I knew about the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. Yes, it's quite a famous thing. Nonetheless, in Israel, there's always been a sense that the Jews who were killed in the Holocaust went like sheep to the slaughter. In other words, there was this double, sort of a paradox. On one hand, we were told that they resisted. On the other hand, they didn't resist. And we were supposed to be the new Jew, the feisty new Jews who are Israelis, who the Sabras, who will never be led like sheep to the slaughter. So there was a double message there, that on one hand, they fought, but on the other, they were also almost willing victims. There was quite a lot of scorn, I think, quite a lot of disrespect by the Zionist movement in Israel, that the authorities there, towards the victims of the Holocaust, as if somehow it was their fault. Because they weren't the feisty Jew who can hold a gun, therefore they deserved what they got, or something like that.
That's, really? Wow.
Yes, yes. Mm. I mean, it's written, it's well documented. You can read it. Any book about the history of Israel will tell you that the attitude to Holocaust victims has been appalling. In fact, so much so that victims, survivors, in fact, haven't just never spoke about their experience until the last 20 years. Whoever's left is now talking, but back then when I was growing up, people just didn't speak about it.
Hmm.
My grandparents never did. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors. Even my own mother never heard any stories from their own experience of the Holocaust.
Did they say much about the Jewish police who actually rounded up their fellow Jews and put them on the trains?
Well, we were taught these sort of things more in the context of moral dilemmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, If you're a Jewish leader of some sort of your community, and the Nazis come to you and they say, look, either you give us this many people from your ghetto or from your community, or we take that many ourselves, or something like that. There was talk about that this horrible moral dilemma. Basically, you can't win. There's no, you know, people will try to do everything they can to survive, and I don't remember it being us looking at people like that with contempt. I think that even as young people, I think we understood that they were put in impossible situations. So it was horrible for mm-hmm. everybody. When you put people in a situation like that, what are they supposed to do? You know, it happened to the Greeks in Greece. The Nazis did similar things to them.
Well, I remember there was a book out, I don't know, maybe about 20 years ago, about a young man. He joined the Jewish police hoping that he could save his wife and child, and it turned out he was wrong. They were sent
everybody
to the camps.
Everybody gets killed anyway. Yeah, and when you're dealing with psychopaths, there's no negotiations. Either mm-hmm. way, you're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the sense was, of course, that the Nazis had all the power, and so there's nothing you can do about that. And that's one of the problems with situations like that, and even with Israel and the Palestinians, is that when one side has all the power and the other side has none, the side that has none can't win.
Well, the Palestinians have very little power. So it's sort of amazing in a way that, you know, the Germans, yeah, they did have all this power, and by the sort of the mythology is that, okay, the sheikh never challenged that power, but then they come to Israel and they kind of take it out on the Palestinians. I mean, is that an unfair way to look at it? Or?
Yeah, but you have to understand the Zionist movement started before the Holocaust.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is not something that was a product of the Holocaust. The Holocaust simply, if you like, confirmed something that the Zionist movement has already believed in or has already followed. And you know a little bit of the history, and you would know that the Zionist movement was formed in the 19th century in Europe against the background of a whole lot of European nationalism. And having a nation state was seen as the solution for the Jewish problem, for Jewish persecution. And that's long before the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Jews suffered persecution, institutionalized anti-Semitism. Nobody denies that. And the Zionist movement basically had this idea that the Jews are suffering. In fact, Theodor Herzl thought that if the Jews are suffering, it's because they're a minority in the countries that they live in, and therefore they should be in a situation where they're no longer a minority, and the only situation that's possible is in a nation state of their own. And up to this point, this is not such a bad idea, really. The only point where it goes wrong is that they decide to create a nation state somewhere where there are people. And the attitude to the indigenous people of Palestine, to the Palestinians, is not terribly dissimilar to the attitude of all colonial powers to indigenous people. That they don't matter, that they're primitives, that they haven't developed the country well enough, that they're kind of in the way of us wanting something. In traditional colonialism, if you look at France and England and Holland and all the countries who colonized different parts of Africa or Asia, India, the aim was to get resources. They wanted money, they wanted labor, they wanted whatever natural resources the country had so that they can finance their own economies. In Palestine, it wasn't so much about resources in that sense. It was that they wanted the land so that Jews can come and settle and have their own nation state, their own independent state. But the outcome of it is the same. The attitude to the indigenous people, the ethnic cleansing, the after effects on the indigenous people, on the Palestinians, refugee camps, the Palestinian Israelis who are living in Israel are having a terrible time and always have, and it's probably going to get worse under this new fairly right-wing government that Netanyahu is now forming, which is a bit scary, and I've been keeping an eye on the news to see what's happening. I don't expect anything good to come out of these people. I quoted Benjamin Netanyahu's father, who just recently, just before the elections in Israel, said that the Holocaust is still going on. This is how Netanyahu was raised. He was raised by a man who believes that the Jews are right now under a Holocaust.
Well, you know, and in a strange way, some of these early Zionists, they kind of embraced anti-Semitism. They talked about, you know, the Jews at that time as kind of being unfit to associate with anybody else. You know, I've seen quotes from them, and they're really, if anybody else has said it, said, you know, this is a very anti-Semitic thing to say.
Well, it's I don't know if it's so much, well, in a way, it's in a perverse way, it is anti-Semitic, but what I think it is, it's internalization of the hatred against you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a persecuted group starting to call itself the same names that the persecutors are calling them. You know, victims of racism can sometimes internalize that racism and actually believe that they are somehow different or inferior to others. But you see, the Jews already have a belief that they're special. Going right back to the Bible, we are the chosen people, supposedly. Supposedly, we have a special relationship with God that no other nation has. I have a problem with so many of the basic Jewish values that it's mind-boggling. I'm really interested in looking into it and writing about it, and I'm sort of doing a bit of work on that as I go. This belief in specialness and differentness has been there right from the start. It's very much a cult belief. I've worked with many people who are survivors of various cults in Australia, because we have cults here too, just like you would in the United States. And there's very much a belief in specialness, in us and them, the other. We're somehow different. The way we do things is better. We have a special relationship with the divine. Those other ones don't. It's only safe in the group. It's not safe outside the group. And the ones out there are somehow not going to enjoy the same kind of salvation we're going to enjoy. And we have to behave in special ways. We have special codes of behavior, special codes of ethics. We might dress more special, in a different way. We might eat special foods. So every cult has its own sort of thing. And I think that Judaism is very much a cult in that sense. And so everything that comes after that follows from it. How a cult becomes a cult, why a group of people choose to be that way, that's an interesting question. Either they've been really persecuted and that happened, or they start out that way because of psychological reasons. Fundamentally, at the center of every cult, there is somebody with a personality disorder who has an interest in getting people to rally around them, admire them, worship them. It happens in many religions and even in non-religious cults. I don't know, perhaps Judaism started the same way too, around Moses. Freud wrote in 1938, a piece called Moses and Monotheism.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily accept his analysis, because it's based on his theories of, the son fighting the father and killing the father and all that. And I'm not big on Freud's theories, but there's a grain of truth in there, and there's a possibility that the Jewish cult started with Moses. From then on, it's become, it's grown to mythical proportions. But it's nothing more than a cult, and it still has the same mentality. And so when a cult goes on throughout history and minds its own business, it doesn't do any damage to anybody else, and it can be persecuted, which will reinforce its own belief in its specialness and all of that. But if a cult then gets a country with power and with military, I think, God help us all. That's, I think, what Israel is.
Well, I think, this sort of goes to what Lord Acton said about absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think this is sort of true of everybody. It's so many examples. Well, then, I think the Christian church is a great example of that. They were persecuted by the Romans, and then Emperor Constantine made it the state religion, and, boy, all of a sudden they're in charge.
And it's kind of interesting, too, because the early Christians were actually persecuted by the Jews in Rome. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I thought it was the Romans who were persecuting
them. The Romans and the Jews persecuted the early Christians. The Jews were a bit threatened by them because they were seen as a sort of a faction that defected from Judaism. The early Christians in Judea were Jews. But then when Christianity spread into the Roman Empire, there were many, many non-Jews who joined Christianity and became Christians. The Jews felt very uncomfortable about it, so they actually helped the Romans in persecuting the Christians. As soon as the Christians become the leaders of Rome and have power, what we think of today as modern anti-Semitism begins. Basically, from then on, Christianity becomes, starts to promote what we call now anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go back to Jesus' original teaching, was trying to teach the Jewish people how to resist Roman domination. That's what salvation meant to him. And he had his attitude towards the Romans was kind of, I guess, civil disobedience, where others, the Pharisees had their way of resisting, the temple priests who were the ones in charge, they were collaborators, and
lots of factions. People mm-hmm. were killing each other.
Oh yeah, the zealots and the dagger assassins. I mean, it was a pretty pretty wild time. Well,
you just have to watch The Life of Brian. Pretty good idea.
Yeah, I hear that some town in Wales just allowed that movie to be shown. One of the actresses in the film is now the mayor of that town.
Strange.
It's in Wales. But you write in your article, I think I have grown sane. How did that happen?
I think if you allow, or if you are not conscious that you suffer from trauma and you live your life in this sort of a fight or flight mentality and this sort of sense that the world is a dangerous and bad place and everybody's out to get you, you're not well. And we have a lot of knowledge about trauma. There's been a lot of brain research. We know heaps about that. And we know that it leaves us stuck in a kind of a fight-or-flight response to the world. You just can't get away from the sense of being under threat all the time. Depending on the particular cause of your trauma, but generally people develop a sense that other people might be dangerous, life might be dangerous, the world is dangerous, people can't be trusted, institutions can't be trusted, everything is unsafe, and you live your life constantly frightened. Fear is the dominant, predominant state of mind for somebody who has trauma. And I'm using the word sane and insane here quite loosely, not in a clinical way, because I don't actually think of people who have trauma as insane, but I also don't think of people who have trauma as healthy. I think the world is not all bad. The world is also not all good. But when you have trauma, you can only see the half-empty part of the glass, not the whole glass. And if you're healthy, you're able to see both. You're able to see the half-empty and the half-full. In that sense, I've grown sane, in a sense that I'm able to see both sides of the world. I'm not exclusively looking at the world as a bad place or as a dangerous place. And another really strong element for me, and that exists in trauma in general, is the personalization of everything. And this is a really important point. People who suffer from trauma don't just see the world in those negative terms, but also personalize. So everything that happens has a meaning to them, and it's to do with them. There's a sense that the persecution is very personal. Whatever's going wrong is going wrong against me. So I'll give you an example. When I used to be right in the heart of my trauma, say the plumbing would go bad and we get a blockage in the drains, right? That can happen. These things mm-hmm. happen. I wouldn't see that as, that's so annoying. I need to go to the plumber now. That's going to be another $200, you know? That's not how I would see that. I would get a sense of doom at the pit of my stomach, as if, oh no, something terrible is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So people with trauma actually see, and that's not unique to me. I've run a private practice for 10 years. I've worked with countless people with trauma. It's the same for everybody. Research shows the same thing. There's a personalization of it. Going sane for me also means not taking everything personally. If the plumbing goes bad, well, you know, bad luck, this happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's annoying. It means I have to call the plumber and pay money, but it's nothing to do with me in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no sense that you're personally cursed or personally persecuted or that there's some agenda, you know, there's some big force, mysterious force in the world that's against you. My mother's particular version of trauma, for example, is she actually believes that I think God hates her.
Really?
My mother has a faith in God, but it's a very, very bad God, I think. It's a very treacherous kind of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like the Greek mythology type of gods. You know, they've got an agenda against you, and they go for you, and they do something bad to you just to see what happens,
just for
the sport of it. And my mother definitely has that kind of faith, and I come from that. I mean, I was heavily influenced by her, and I had that belief, I think, that I don't think I believed that God was against me, but there was certainly some kind of a cosmic force.
Mm-hmm.
So going sane means losing these beliefs, losing the belief that the world is bad, predominantly bad, that people hate me, that I'm in danger all the time, and that everything that happens is personal, and that I'm somehow cursed. And I lost that. You know, I don't believe I'm special anymore. I believe I'm a human being. And like a human being, I share the fate of all other human beings and creatures on this planet, and nothing's personal. If the planet becomes unsustainable tomorrow and we can't live anymore, then that includes me. I'm not special either way. So, and to me, that's going sane.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Our time is up. Is there any, you've been writing and been active in peace movements in Australia. Is there any way that people can read your writing? Do you have a website or anything?
Yes, I do. And would you like me to give the address?
Yes, would you?
Okay, and you might have to repeat that if my accent is...
Okay, we'll do that. Okay.
Clear. So it's www.
Okay.
Dot Abigail Abarbanel, one word.
Okay, I'll spell that out. AVIGAILABARBANEL. Abigail Abarbanel.
Dot me.
Me as
me for ME for myself, me.
Oh, okay, all right.
Dot UK.
Okay, Abigail Abarbanel dot me dot UK. All right, well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for talking to me, Pam. Nice to know you that way.
Well, I think I'd like to catch up on some more of your writings, and maybe we can talk some more in the future. Thank you very much.
I'm delighted. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And this is Per Fogring, KBOO News and Public Affairs. Stay tuned.
I'm Stephanie Potter with KBOO Radio. The time is about 9:31, and I'm here with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. Andrew Nikiforuk is an author and journalist well-known in Canada who's won multiple national magazine awards, and his book Tar Sands is a riveting account of the true costs of mining for oil in Canada and a wake-up call for all of us who want our energy security to come from Canadian tar fields. He'll be speaking here in Portland tonight at a KBOO fundraiser from 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th and Main. And I know that there's a lot to talk about, so if we don't get to it all, you're going to be able to hear it there tonight. The event is sponsored by a number of peace and environmental groups, and it's a fundraiser, but no one will be turned away. And so, Andrew, I just want to welcome you to KBOO.
Great. Thank you, Stephanie.
I want to start. I know the tar sands are being mined for oil in Canada, and it's in an area north of a place called Fort McMurray. And I checked that area out on Google Maps and then looked at pictures on websites. And, you know, I really felt like I was looking at the land of Mordor. I mean, it was surreal. Like in that book, The Lord of the Rings, it was rock and shale and monster digging machines. And from your book, I realized that the giant lakes that I saw are really just giant holding ponds for toxic wastewater. And I know that right now it's like the size of Belgium, about 12,000 square miles, but it's expected to grow to the size of Nepal or Florida, 60,000 square miles. And I just wanted to start by asking, have you been there yourself in person? I know you must have.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm from Alberta, so this project has taken place sort of in my backyard, and I've been to Fort McMurray a number of times. I first went up there in 1998, and then many more times in 2006, 2007. And, you know, this is the world's largest energy project, and we are proposing to really to industrialize a forest area the size of Florida to provide energy security for half of Canada and much of the U.S. Midwest and Rocky Mountain states and Washington state.
And so just being there and looking around at it, how did that make you feel?
Well, I mean, it's Alexandra Fuller, who's a U.S. Journalist, talks about moral carelessness when you talk about hydrocarbon booms, and that's what the place is like. It is quite extraordinary. It is an earth-destroying economy, and it's not only the waterways and the air and the forest that have been affected, But the people who work there have also been affected and abused in many ways because we're rushing this project. I mean, it's an example of damn the torpedoes kind of thing and get this thing on stream without a national conversation in Canada and really without a national conversation in the United States.
Right. Well, maybe, and then just to get going a little more, to get into the details around this, in your book you make a lot of distinctions between bloody oil and dirty oil, and the tar sand Canadian oil you consider dirty. And it comes from something called, in Canada, bitumen, but we call it here in the United States bitumen.
Or bitumen, yeah.
Bitumen.
Yeah.
And maybe you could just get into just what is that exactly?
Well, this resource is not oil floating on top of sand, right? This is as industry and government Canadian government like to convey. Bitumen is a really third-rate hydrocarbon. It's very, very dense and very heavy. It won't move through a pipeline unless you dilute it with light oil or condensate. And it's locked in sand and clay under the forest floor. And the shallow deposits can be mined, and the deeper deposits have to be steamed out. They have to be melted with hot steam. And so incredibly energy process. And once you get the bitumen out, now, it is so carbon-rich and so hydrogen-poor that you then have to upgrade it, and that takes more energy. And then after that, you then have to put it through a complex refinery. So this is industry calls it an ugly resource or difficult oil, or it's just dirty oil because it has a water footprint, a carbon footprint, an energy footprint, and a land use footprint that's so much more extreme than that for light conventional crude. So we made a sea shift change here. And pretty much the exploitation of the tar sands is very much a signature peak oil. Half of the world's cheap oil is gone, and what's left is this dirty stuff at the bottom of the barrel.
That's really expensive, really hard to get out.
It is the world's most expensive oil.
And for instance, like the forests, what are you doing? It's boreal forests up there where songbirds used to have their homes and stuff. What's happening to those forests?
Well, I mean, the mining projects are simply just are earth-destroying. I mean, you just dig up the forest. And that will be over about a 1,000-square-mile area. So you can put 3 New York cities proper in the mining portion. And that's actually the smallest portion of the project. The largest portion will be occupied by the steam plants. And what the steam plants do, they look kind of like conventional oil and gas facilities, lots of pipelines, seismic lines, well pads and these plants. And that will really fragment the forest. And what industry studies are saying is that as a result of that fragmentation and all these spider web of industrial activity, we're going to lose a lot of species. And so the woodland caribou will likely go. The nesting habitat for boreal songbirds will go. The fish will go. The lynx will go. The bear will go. And so we're really going to diminish wildlife in most of this region.
Yeah, and the water. That was horrifying to me.
The water is extreme. I mean, it takes 3 barrels of fresh water to produce 1 barrel of bitumen. And the bitumen has to go into like a washing machine and you separate it. You add caustic soda and you separate the bitumen from the sand and the clay. And then you have this huge wastewater stream. As a result, so you've got huge consumption of water, and then you have this wastewater stream, which is extraordinary, and the tailings lakes of toxic waste now occupy 50 square miles of forest up there. They're among the world's largest impoundments of toxic waste, and they're full of stuff like naphthenic acids and arsenic and mercury and phenols and ammonia and chlorides and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, so fish killers and cancer makers. And it's an extraordinary wastewater problem for Canada to have. It's probably the world's largest collection of toxic water impoundments. And in fact, it's equivalent. I mean, people in Alberta Environment have told me that's really equivalent to 300 Love Canals at this point in time.
Wow. And the Athabasca River, where this is all taking place, is the third largest waterway in Canada, but it's being drained, basically.
Well,
right?
You know, the Athabasca is actually part of the world's third largest watershed, which is probably called the Mackenzie River Basin.
Uh-huh.
And so the Athabasca feeds into the Mackenzie River, which feeds into the Arctic. And, you know, the only other larger waterways are the Amazon and the Mississippi. And so, yeah, here we have the world's largest energy project in the world, in one of the world's largest watersheds, which currently protects about a sixth of Canada's freshwater supply.
And another issue with this, quickly, is the CO2.
The carbon footprint, yeah. Canada's carbon footprint and America's is just getting bigger. Because it takes so much energy to produce bitumen that the carbon footprint from the production of this resource is 20 to 30% greater than that for conventional oil.
20 to 30%. So Canada, like I read, is becoming one of the largest carbon producers on the whole planet.
Well, the tar sands are the largest single source of carbon emissions for Canada. It represents 5% of the country's emissions. And, we are among, on a per capita basis, we are one of the world's leading creators of CO2. And we really should be leaders, right? I mean, we should be setting an example for India and China and for other countries and say, look, we can cut back. We don't have to behave like we're driving monster trucks around all over the place.
And another issue with this is that the reclamation, the Canadian government is saying, well, and the industry is saying that this is going to be reclaimed. But you wrote that it amounts to putting lipstick on a corpse, the kind of reclamation projects that are taking place.
Well, I kind of looked at the record in the United States for mountaintop removal, and I said, okay, what's happened out there? And, of course, you remove the mountain, you kill a hardwood forest, and what you replace it with is a grassland. And, in fact, that's pretty much the model for the tar sands, is that you remove the boreal forest, you try to reclaim what's left, and you're only getting about 50% of the biological diversity back. You're not recreating the wetlands at all, and most of this area is all wetland. And you're getting these impoverished grasslands as a substitute.
So desert in northern Canada.
Well, if we don't get a lot of water and because of climate change and there's more drought up there, then yeah, we will essentially have deserts up there as opposed to grasslands. But what we're doing is not sustainable in any way, and it's not honest for government or industry to say they're going to replace what they've taken away. They're not. They can't.
Yeah, the shale and the rock, it didn't look like it. I'm speaking with Andrew Nikiforuk. He's the author of an excellent eye-opener of a book, Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. You can hear more of him tonight. He'll be speaking at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland, Southwest 12th and Salmon, from 7 to 9. It's a fundraiser for KBOO, but no one will be turned away. Another thing that was really hard to read in your book is how in the 60s the government was seriously considering detonating nuclear bombs to melt the tar sands, and I guess nukes are still being promoted by Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the nuclear story is quite fascinating. In the 1960s, somebody proposed to the Alberta government, look, we know it's really hard to get this stuff out of the ground. Why don't we just, set off a nuke underground and create this huge cavity and then put some pump jacks on top and pump it out? And the Alberta government thought that was great. The American government said, that's a cool idea. We'll give you the bomb. And the Richfield Oil Company said, okay, well, we've got a site. And fortunately, saner minds prevailed, and the Russians tried this only to discover that there is no market yet for radioactive oil. But the nukes are still playing a prominent role up there because of the energy intensity of the resource. I mean, Canada could spend in the next 10 years, business as usual, $200 billion alone on natural gas to create bitumen.
In other words, to heat it, to melt it.
That's right. And to boil the water for the steam plants and all that sort of stuff. An enormous energy form of energy cannibalism. So the solution, of course, is, okay, now we're going to build some nukes up there, and we're going to use the nukes to generate the power we need to accelerate bitumen production. But, that would make Canada and the United States the world's first countries to use nuclear power not to get off fossil fuels, but to actually accelerate fossil fuel production. Extraordinary. But there are three proposals now in northern Alberta alone.
So this is moving ahead still.
This is moving ahead. This is on the agenda for the Alberta government and for the oil and gas industry.
Oh, great. And another thing, just to sort of talk about you again, you've lived in Calgary for 20 years, and I was wondering, the social impacts of this that I was reading about in your book are also pretty tremendous. And could you just talk about some of the changes you've seen in Calgary?
They've been phenomenal. Basically, when you have a project the size of the tar sands and $200 billion investment over a 10-year period, we've had 700,000 people pour into the province. And everything changed overnight. I mean, the number of car accidents, the waiting times at hospitals, the cost of housing, you couldn't get service in any of the stores. So the quality of life really dramatically changed in Alberta, and you couldn't help but notice it. So, that the entire province became a suburb of Fort McMurray and became this incredible boom town. And that's changed dramatically with the financial meltdown, because a lot of these projects now are on hold and they've taken a lot of money off the table, which is great because it gives us breathing room, and it also gives us an opportunity to really talk about the pace and scale of this project. And Canada really needs to have that conversation.
Right.
What the hell do we want to achieve with this? Yeah.
Right. And actually, I've been under the impression that Canadians had a really strong environmental consciousness, more here even in the U.S. And so it's surprising.
That's not true. That's not true, Stephanie. No. We're natural resource developers, right? We like to pluck trees out of the forest and rocks out of the ground and to sell it. And we don't often add much value to these products either. But and for 400 years, that's what we've been largely about. And now we've become this, you know, supplier of bitumen to the United States. And it's really changed us as a nation. And it's we're becoming really fixed on hydrocarbons. And, in fact, you can't become the number one supplier of oil to the world's mightiest empire without changing a whole bunch of things about you. And the first thing that has happened in Canada is that it has really tarnished our environmental reputation, because we're not dealing with the climate change issues. We're not dealing. We have no firm program for renewables. We don't even have a national water policy, and you know, we're one of the few industrial countries in the world without an energy program or plan. I mean, unbelievable.
So, and you describe really that it's a kind of thing that goes on, though, with this sort of petrochemical dollars that they do lead to kind of more corruption, authoritarianism, and the
oil will bend you. It doesn't matter what, you know, if you start out as a democracy and you become a major oil producer, it will bend you over time. I mean, American political scientists, Michael Ross, Eric Wibbles, I mean, they've looked at this phenomenon. They said, okay, why are there no democracies in the Middle East? Well, there are two, actually. There are Israel and Lebanon, but neither one has oil. Okay, so, I mean, oil twists and bends and will crank you out of shape over time unless you have a program to deal with the wealth. And if you take the money off the table, then the government will stop representing the resource and will represent its people once again. Norway learned this lesson. They had a big debate about oil. They said, what do we do with the proceeds? Parties of the left and the right said, you know what, it'll destroy us unless we put it all into a fund. So 90% of the money goes up into this fund. It's off the table. The government has to run like a normal government. We haven't done that in Canada. In Alberta, we're running on hydrocarbon dollars. And our government, sounds like Saudi Arabia. I mean, all they talk about is the resource and development of the resource. The same thing in federal Canada. So oil will twist you over time, and we've certainly got bent out of shape up in Canada.
And so the people in Canada, or Alberta especially, they're getting back like tax breaks like Sarah Palin did in Alaska.
Well, the first thing in a petrostate, when you're making a whole month of money from a resource, so 20% of your revenue is at least coming from, you know, from oil, or it could be from diamonds or trees or whatever, any natural resource, then you get bent out of shape. And the first thing you do is reduce taxes to make everyone feel warm and fuzzy about governments they shouldn't feel warm and fuzzy about. Alaska's done it, Wyoming, Texas, Alberta, most of the Middle East. The first thing you do, a petrostate does, is to get rid of taxes. Well, what happens? There's no representation without taxation. And so then the governments represent the resource, because that's where most of the money's coming from.
And even like that, Stephen Harper's administration is spending millions on PR for the oil industry.
Well, it's not the federal government that's really spending that money. It's the government of Alberta. With $25 million they are now spending to tell Americans that, hey, no worries, our product is clean. And it's a deceptive, you know, example of government propaganda at its worst. And really, they should be saying, you know what, guys, we've developed this resource too quickly. Yes, it is dirty. It's got a huge carbon and water footprint, and we need to address those issues, and we need to slow down. And the United States should really be asking itself, but, you know, a crack dealer is not going to say this to you, but, you know, switching from bloody oil to dirty oil is a bit like taking your energy mortgage from Countrywide Financial to Bear Stearns. And that maybe it's time to really ask the question, well, maybe we should get off oil, period. And maybe for, you know, every dollar that's invested in the tar sands, there should be two invested in renewables. So we prepare for the future and tomorrow rather than getting stuck in the sand.
Exactly. I'm speaking with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of an excellent eye-opener of a book, Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent. And as I've said earlier, you can hear more of him tonight. We're just touching the surface of this. He'll be speaking at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland, Southwest 12th and Salmon, from 7 to 9 p.m. tonight. And as I said, it's a fundraiser for KBOO, but no one will be turned away. And so just to get into this a little more, you can't neglect, or we can't neglect, the U.S. connection. We are pretty much the biggest customer of this oil, right?
You are the only customer at this point in time.
We're the only customer,
yeah.
Even here in Oregon.
Well, even in Oregon, I mean, Oregon is kind of an interesting island here because you get most of your oil is coming from refineries in California or refineries in Washington State. In Washington State, 10% of the feedstock now is coming from Canada. So you're running on crude processed crude from Alaska, the Middle East, and Canada that being processed in refineries either in Washington State or California.
Wow, a lot of this is going to the Midwest, right? The Midwest,
yeah,
is running almost entirely on.
Well, not entirely, but almost a third of the oil that is now being consumed in the U.S. Midwest, and that's Barack Obama country, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Dakotas, is coming from Canada. From the tar sands.
And how does the North American Free Trade Act factor into all of this?
Well, it factors into it in the sense that we signed the agreement and we signed a proportionality clause which says that we can't claw back production and without guaranteeing a certain percentage of what we're exporting to the United States. A very good clause for the U.S., not a particularly good clause for Canada.
Right. So right now, Canada's 64% of it, the bitumen is coming, and it's even supposed to increase to 70% of Canada's bitumen is supposed to come to the U.S.?
Right now, we're producing more than 1 million barrels a day. The plans are to increase it to 3 million barrels a day, and at some point by 2030,
when?
By 5 million barrels a day. So by 2015, 2020, the industry and government hope to have 3 million barrels on
and
stream.
And that means more and more going from the size of a little tiny country to Florida, basically, right?
Yeah, we'll be extending the area that is increasingly being industrialized by this project.
Right.
You know, if we go full bore on it, we will industrialize an area the size of Florida.
Right. And so all of this is part of, like, feeding America's energy needs.
That's what it's all about. We're saying, okay, look, guys, we're providing you with security. It's vast. It's secure. And you know what? You're not funding religious extremists up in Canada. But on the other hand, the more you get stuck on this resource, the less money, energy, and time is being spent on renewables. And that's the big conversation the United States needs to have. How much do you want to get stuck in the sand, and how much do you want to prepare for tomorrow's economy, which means investing in renewables and keeping your energy dollars at home, renewing local economies. And,
right,
you know, and I think that's a really important conversation for the U.S. to have.
And
I mean, we'll take all your money. I mean, Canadians, we don't care. Give us we'll take all your dollars. But you know, I don't think that's good for the United States in the end. I actually don't think it's going to be good for Canada. You're going to bend us out of shape, and you guys are not going to be able to get yourself out of this financial mess you're in. And the amount of money the U.S. spends on oil has been a contributing factor to the financial meltdown here in the States. So I think the business message for the United States is, you know what, get smart about this. Invest your energy dollars at home in renewables, and at the same time that you're taking some of this oil, because the transition is going to take a while. It's going to take 10 to 15, 20 years.
Exactly. And
yeah.
And Obama's stimulus package, I think, had a lot in it about, you know, investing in green energy. And I know that he met recently with Stephen Harper. Was there a sense that there might be some changes then with this through him?
I don't know. I don't know where Obama's going on all of this. Canada has been caught off guard. We have no plan B in case you guys decide to put a carbon tax on this resource, which I think you should probably do. And so Obama is, you know, he knows enough that you can't shut this project down without shutting down the U.S. Midwest. So I think he's still trying to figure out his way here, and he really needs to ramp up the whole renewable energy industry in the United States if he really wants to make a difference. But in the end, U.S. demand will decide the pace and scale of this project.
And I know that Congressman Waxman, I guess a couple of years ago, he tried to get some legislation through that would just so that government couldn't buy tar sand oil.
Well, he was saying, the Energy Independence Act was basically saying, look, we don't want the U.S. military and the post office, you know, among the largest consumers of petroleum in the United States, to be running on high carbon fuels. Okay, we want you to run on conventional stuff or low carbon fuels, and that's an interesting idea. And he's you know, so it's really started a real conversation about the source of energy, where it's coming from, and what should be the penalties if you're using stuff that's really warming up the planet at a pretty incredible rate.
Right. And you said that the recent drop in prices have been slowing it down, but we are sort of dealing now with peak oil, so, or we will be soon, and that's going to inevitably make the price rise again, and that's going to maybe start up the whole tar sand thing big time. It just keeps going.
Yeah, well, very much. This is very much a signature peak oil, this whole project. And what's happened with the financial meltdown, it has illustrated how expensive this project is, right? So, I mean, a lot of the steam plants can't make money at $40 a barrel.
Right.
So they're losing money, and they're burning natural gas and producing bitumen, but they're not making any money at all. The mines, they can still make a profit at $40. But it's illustrating, you know, just again, how unsustainable this project is, even from a capital investment sort of plan. But, you know, the price of oil will probably go back up again. A lot of stuff will come back on stream. We're talking about some of the world's most powerful corporations up there: Shell, Exxon, Mobil, ConocoPhillips, Statoil, BP, all of the major state-owned companies. So, I mean, this is the last place in the world, if you're an oil company, where you can still grow production and guarantee some kind of security for your shareholders in the future of your company. And so, I mean, the project is really about security for multinationals, as opposed to really security for the continent. But, you know, this project is telling us in very loud, brash, and messy way that business as usual with energy cannot continue.
Right, and just that whole thing with where big multinational corporations are involved in it. Do you think that has to do? You wrote that that no major newspaper to date has actually even bothered to assign a reporter to Athabasca to you know, cover this nation-changing event. And is that basically why the media is ignoring this, is to protect multinationals, or what's going on with that?
Well, I don't think, I mean, there are a lot of problems in the media today. The media is having its own kind of media meltdown, you know, and no, I just found it very strange. I mean, none of the major national papers in Canada have opened a bureau in Fort McMurray, and they probably should have done so about 10 years ago, because, I mean, this is an extraordinary event. It has changed Canada, the character of Canada. It's also beginning to change the character of the United States. The more hooked you get to this resource, it will change the whole relationship between Canada and the United States over time. And, I don't understand why our national newspapers and our national radio, CBC, never opened a bureau up there. They should have, because it is such an extraordinary event. And had they done so, maybe more Canadians at this point in time would know about this project, and probably more Americans as well.
Right. And, well, do you feel like maybe the Internet might be having an influence, bloggers and websites, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot of stuff out there right now. And but I would have liked to see actually more mainstream coverage.
And
so that only about 3 out of 10 Canadians know that we're now the number one supplier of oil to the U.S. And only about 2 out of 10 Americans know that that's where your chief supplier. And that needs to change. You know, people, if you want to survive as a civilization or as a society, you have to become aware, number one, of where your food is coming from,
right,
and who's making it, and where your fuel is coming from, and what does it cost socially, politically, economically, and environmentally, and how sustainable is that? And that's the conversation we need to have right now.
So that's like one thing we need to be doing. Could you name just a couple of other things that would be pretty cool?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, America has to have a conversation about the fact that you can't be running on dirty oil without really concrete, heavy programs to convert to renewables at the same time. You've got to have a parallel program there. I think what this project again shows to everyone is that everything is now about energy and the cost of energy, and money is just something we have to buy energy. And it again highlights us the importance of what renewables are about. They're about renewing local economies and keeping your energy dollars at home. I think at some point the United States has got to slap a huge and heavy carbon tax on this product that will be good for – that will tell Americans, whoa, this ain't conventional stuff anymore. This is dirty. And it will tell Canadians, you know what, you better clean up your act. And And lastly, I it would be nice if you guys could talk to us, too, about some kind of fiscal accountability about this project so we could learn from the Norway example. And so we don't become a twisted and bent democracy that's only about the export of hydrocarbons. And that's where Canada's going.
This is really an incredible topic. Cable listeners can learn more and get more involved by going to your website, which is...
www.andrewnickyfork.com, and there's so many good sites on the tar sands and oil sands. I mean, you just Google either one, and you'll come up with more stuff than you can want to read, actually.
And we can hear, one thing we can all do is hear more about this issue, and as I've been saying, you'll be talking more tonight as part of a fundraiser for KABU at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland, Southwest 12th and Main, from 7 to 9. And there's a lot of great organizations sponsoring this event, including Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group. And even though it's a fundraiser, no one's going to be turned away for lack of funds. And I just want to say thanks a lot, Andrew, for being here.
It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation, Stephanie.
Good. And I've been speaking with Andrew Nickyfork, author of an excellent wake-up call of a book, Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. I just want to thank you again for coming to KABU. And I'm Stephanie Potter. This is KABU Radio. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party featured DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KABU Celeste Carey, and the MRG Foundation/KABU Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
And it is almost 10 a.m., and you are listening to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein interviews Marjorie Cohen, president of the National Lawyers Guild, about a Spanish judge targeting members of the Bush administration for war crimes. Later, Dennis speaks with former CIA operative Ray McGovern about President Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. At 11 on stage and studio, hear about Tears of Joy Theater's production of This Fabulous Bear. Also, art historian W.J.T. Mitchell talks about the impact of imagery on the psyche. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews local artist Chris Haberman about his upcoming show.